morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, February 27th, 2017, and I am opening a meeting of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today, we will be opening a public hearing on House Bill 5032 related to the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Ms. Ames, let's get us started here.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, so today is a Psychiatric Security Review Board, and it's the first little agency that we're hearing in this forum. We scheduled it now because this agency has significant linkages with both the Oregon State Hospital and the community mental health system, as you'll hear more about. Just a reminder, the two-page LFO summary of the agency is out on OLIS, as well as their big governor's budget, and then the agency presentation materials. There will be public testimony at the end of the hearing, so I did want to let people know if you wanted to testify, there's a hearing sign-up sheet back at the back table. Okay.
Go ahead. Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Hayfield, members of the committee. I'm Juliet Britton. I'm Executive Director of the PSRB. With me, I have...
I'm Elena Balduzzi. I'm a psychologist. I'm the psychologist board member and chair of the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
Michelle Lisper, Chief Financial Officer.
So we're going to give an overview. My understanding is many of the committee members are new, so we're going to... I watched the Oregon State Hospital's presentation, so we're going to kind of piggyback and have some of the same themes and information, specifically how our agency intersects with the community mental health as well as the state hospital. So we have four major program areas, several of which are relatively newer responsibilities. The primary responsibility is that we are the agency that supervises those who successfully assert an insanity defense to a criminal charge. We're often called the Board of Parole of those with mental illness. That's sort of not enough information as to exactly what we do. In our state, the adults that assert insanity are found guilty except for insanity. So if you hear the acronym GEI, that is what that refers to. For youth, it's called responsible except for insanity, also called REI. We also supervise a very narrow population that are civilly committed and placed under our supervision. That's a result of a recent legislative change several years ago. It's called Senate Bill 421, but we call it ORS 426 because that's the actual civil commitment statute. We can talk about that. We only have seven individuals that are committed under this statute, so compared to the regular civil commitment, it's a very, very small population in Oregon who are placed under our supervision under civil commitment. We also were given by this body the gun relief authority for those that have a mental health adjudication and are therefore barred under state and federal law from having their firearms can come to our body and request restoration of the firearms. Similar to how felons can go to district court, circuit court, and request their firearm privileges, individuals with mental health determinations can come to our agency for that. It's the ATF-recognized gun relief program in Oregon. And then finally, similar to the Board of Parole, we are responsible for implementing a relatively newer law where we're classifying all of our sex offenders based on a 3-2-1 risk category, as well as standing up a sex offender relief program. So we're responsible for the sex offenders that have been found GEI. Board of Parole is responsible for the sex offenders who are found guilty.
Senator Weers.
A question. How many sex offenders do you have currently that are going to that you're going to classify? I know that you have until 2018 to complete the task. So what's the number? And then how much time is devoted? How much time does it take in order to conduct this activity?
co-chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Rayfield, Senator Winters. We have 93 current clients that are sex offenders. 30 of those are still at the state hospital, so they do not yet have to be classified. We have a total of 200 sex offenders that have ever been under our jurisdiction that need classification. We're about a third complete with that. You know, we're going back and historically looking at previous clients that were sex offenders and classifying them. We're using existing resources to complete those statics. I have three FTE that have received the specialty training. Each of them do one static a week, and we'll be able to meet the statutory deadline to have all of those individuals classified by 2018.
Are you running follow-up? Are you encountering any problem in getting the information that you need in order to do the classification?
Senator Winters, we are not, and that's primarily because these individuals were under our supervision, and we have the existing records because we archive our records for 100 years. So we we have all the existing records, so we're not having to pull records from other agencies. So for the most part, we have everything at our fingertips, luckily.
Are you doing any consultation with parole and post-prison release?
Co-chairs Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, Senator Winters, we work very closely with Board of Parole, particularly when we were setting up the program. We wanted to make sure that we had mirrored processes. Our agency is lucky in the fact that our numbers are just so much lower than their numbers. So
they are having difficulty.
They have thousands to classify. And I think that's the big difference between our agencies.
Thank you.
So that's an overview of our four primary responsibilities. Since we are following the state hospital and the lengthy discussion on the 370, this is what we don't do. So we do not supervise those that are found unable to aid and assist, also called the 370. Those folks are all pretrial, and so therefore they have not been adjudicated and placed under our jurisdiction. We also don't provide any clinical services, and we don't fund any of the services or treatment that our board mandates. So just like the regular consumer that receives services, services are paid for Medicaid, private pay, general fund, a mixture of all of those different resources, veterans benefits. So it's very similar in terms of funding. So this is a graphical of where we are in the criminal justice system. For those of you that sit on the Public Safety Subcommittee, we're at the end of the court process. So we don't really have any role pre-trial when they're 370 or unable to aid and assist, nor do we really have any role when they're determining whether or not they should be found guilty except for insanity. We get a judgment order after the court hearing is said and done. Once an individual is placed under our jurisdiction, there is no more court involvement whatsoever. So it doesn't go back to the judge to have them periodically review. Once somebody's placed under our jurisdiction, that jurisdiction remains until they end jurisdiction. So the history is very interesting. Oregon, when I go to national conferences, we really are considered progressive in how we manage those that successfully assert the insanity defense. Back in the late 70s, judges came to the legislature and said, you know, we have the responsibility to supervise individuals in the community and make decisions whether they should leave the state hospital, and we don't have that expertise, mental health expertise, and we don't have the staff personnel to supervise individuals once they're in the community to make sure that they remain safe and stable. And so then the idea resulted from a work group, and this freestanding agency idea came up, and that's how the PSRB was created in the late 70s. We were the first state to do this. Several states have followed our suit. Some states have tried and failed, usually due to funding issues. And I think now when you look at our recidivism rate and and how we're able to successfully monitor individuals, move them forward in recovery without putting public safety at risk. It really speaks to the longevity of our program. And I think these additional duties that we've talked about were given to our agency because we're viewed as the mental health risk experts.
Question. Senator Ware.
Two things. Thank you. You just jogged my little mind. How are you on now, length of stay, since we've made the changes? Has it been shortened? Have there been, is it lengthened?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, Senator Winters, I have a chart coming up that's going to show you.
I'll wait.
And definitely our length of stay has gone down. For several reasons, and we'll continue with that. Primarily, it's because we have a robust community mental health system where we have a continuum of care. So I'll get to that in a second here. Our mission is public safety, but that does not equate to locking individuals up into the state hospital the entire length of stay. Data suggests that after some reasonable hospitalization, the most successful individuals actually do better when they're slowly reintegrated prior to ending jurisdiction. So we use that as a basis for our decisions. We have 10 board members. All are part-time board members, so that's a little different than Board of Parole that has full-time board members. So virtually all of our board members have their own employment outside of the agency. They receive $358 every day they work. We hold hearings once a week, and it's multidisciplinary, which, again, best practices is multidisciplinary decisions tend to be the most effective. So we have a mixture of clinical, legal, and public safety on our board, and that's all per statute. We have 11 FTE, and our budget is about $3 million. And last year, we conducted over 600 hearings. That is how our board does business. For the day-to-day operations, that really falls into my arena, as well as the FTE that are supervised. So we meet our objectives by conducting our hearings and making decisions. Most are statutorily mandated. And then the bigger piece is overseeing the individuals that are living in the community on conditional release and making sure that they should remain in the community or receive any services if things change. A big piece of what I do is working collaboratively with our partners, specifically the Oregon State Hospital, as well as our community mental health. When our individuals are placed in the community, they don't go to probation, they don't go to public safety entities, they're placed in the care and supervision of the county mental health. And so it's critical as we make our decisions and put individuals in the community that we have a collaborative relationship with both of these entities.
So let me ask you a question about that. Under federal law, when a person's been adjudicated and is in the state in DOC custody, not with a GEI but with an actual conviction, then the state is responsible for their health care needs, including all their mental health. That's general fund money. When they are under your supervision and they go out into the community, is that all state general fund, or are they then Medicaid eligible also?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, it's not general fund when somebody's in the community. So you can get Medicaid match, you can bill private insurance.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. I'm sorry, Representative Alonso Leon.
Yes, I have a quick question. Can you go back to the prior slide, please? Can you remind me how many board members you have, and it says they get a stipend of $358. How many days worth of stipends do board members get?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Leon.
Alonso Leon,
excuse me. We hold hearings 3 to 4 times a month, and we have three board members on each hearing day. So that's the monthly estimate for stipends.
You could
I think the question is, on average of your members, how many days a week, and not just you have three, but if you were to give us an on average of the compensation for your board member?
I would have to look that up. Can I look that up, and then maybe we'd have an answer at the end? Do you mean for the biennium, for a year, or every month? I mean, it's about, you know, so it'd be 358 times.
I can tell you my 1099.
Okay, that would be.
So,
that's great.
And are you
having
average?
Just filed my taxes. So last year, my earnings were in the neighborhood of $19,000 a year. And this year, they were a little less, around 18,000. And I'm one of the more regular mm-hmm. board members that sits on 2 to 3 hearings a month.
So at maximum with 10 members, you'd be talking about $190,000
for the
year?
The adult panel meets because so each of the panels is comprised of one of those disciplines.
No, I wasn't being clear. I apologize. If all of there are 10 board members, right, and if all of them were to get as much as you got, mm-hmm. then that would be $190,000 because that's 10 times 19 mm-hmm. over the course of the year. So that's the maximum that we're talking about because, as you said, yours is probably higher because you participate more. Am I understanding correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, to add to that, our juvenile panel, we only have 8 youth, and so they are not meeting even once
right.
a month.
Right.
So that would be a very conservative. It's going to be much lower than that based on
sure.
the juvenile
I'm
activity.
I'm just looking at the upper
yes,
limit. So
absolutely.
We're not talking about a very large sum of money here. Okay.
No.
Thank you.
So this is the snapshot of where we are today. 581 individuals are under our supervision. We have, I include the 207, those are the number of GEI patients in the hospital. That's going to include SHARP, State Hospital Review Panel. If you recall from Superintendent Roberts' briefing, that's the Oregon Health Authority panel that supervises, I think there are maybe around 70 patients. And the PSRB is the entity that's supervising all of those living out in the community as well. So this is the chart, Senator Winters, that I was referring to. It's not length of stay, but it does tell the story of what happens when the legislature funds community mental health programs.
Would you, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Would you go back a little bit before you get into the issue of the resources in the community? Because there were several things that occurred in order to get us there. One was changing the actual relationship between the state hospital and PSRB, putting some elements in there so that you're actually working closer with the state hospital before release. So you've got that piece. And then the how well that is working, and then how well we have done in the resource development for the community residential part.
So we've started back in 2011 or so, this legislature passed several bills that really aim to improve this chart, frankly. Although we were making progress prior to that, as you can see, starting in 2009, our numbers of individuals being placed in the community was starting its trend of moving upward. And that was primarily because several community developments that were specifically developed for our population were funded and created. And so the numbers started going up. Then we had our House Bill 3100, which is the Certified Evaluator Program. That requires a GEI. Cannot be accepted by a judge unless a certified evaluator, a PhD or psychiatrist, has evaluated the patient for appropriateness for PSRB supervision. And that was aimed to improve the quality of GEIs. I mean, frankly, prior to that, there were often stipulated GEIs with no clinician weighing in on the mental state of the defendant, literally stipulating this individual has a mental illness. These are attorneys, being one myself, I feel like I can say that with laughing. But so 2012, that really, I think, we started seeing an improvement of the quality of GEIs. And then, as Senator Winters points out, the Oregon Health Authority's SHARP State Hospital Review Panel was created. And that panel is responsible for supervising, only when they're in the hospital, the non-Measure 11 or Tier 2 GEI patients. And so we work collaboratively with SHARP, because whenever they propose somebody should go out in the community, they allow us to weigh in on that and to suggest conditions.
So just to clarify, then, I probably missed something. If you go to those numbers, you have 207 GEI at OSH. Those are all Measure 11 GEI ones, or those include the SHARP ones that you're the level 2, the Tier 2s, non-Measure 11s that you're talking about? Is there overlap between those two sets?
Senator Steiner-Hayward, that's overlap. So that would include PSRB and SHARP.
Got it. Thank you.
I thought I could have broken it down. I thought it was important that you know the total population
GEI.
Yeah,
no, I agree.
So this shows the trends. Again, continuing community development and funding for our board to have programs to place individuals in the community. As you can imagine, really to adequately supervise individuals with co-occurring disorders, with a history of violence, most of which have Measure 11 violence, really requires a special type of community mental health programming, and funding certainly is required, specifically staffing, intensive treatment. None of our individuals are sitting around all day and watching TV. Our individuals are getting intensive services and have a lot of structure around their everyday life, which we can talk about when we talk about what it means to be on conditional release. But as you can see, the red line is the number of our folks that are on conditional release. Blue line is the Oregon State Hospital. So the trend has definitely reversed. It's the exact opposite, frankly, of the 370 population, which we're very proud of.
Madam Senator, only thing missing in this is, what is your, now that we've instituted some changes, what is your return or your recidivism rates now?
So we have Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Representative Rayfield. We have an excellent recidivism rate. Thank you.
Just leading you into the...
Our recidivism rate, even though we have the highest number of individuals on conditional relief, our recidivism rate has not dramatically increased. And again, it speaks to the quality of programming that we have in the community. This definition is not the DOC definition, but I had my staff crunch the numbers using, arrests and whatnot. We don't have that many more arrests than we do convictions, and it wouldn't dramatically change the recidivism rate. So it's still less than 1%, despite having the most individuals on conditional release.
Yeah, sorry, Chair Wakefield.
And so when you're calculating recidivism, how far are you tracking out in terms of years when you're comparing the definitions?
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Representative Rayfield, it's cumulative, so it's beyond just the 3 years. So it even speaks higher than Department of Corrections in terms of longevity. So it's cumulative. That's why there's an average.
Great.
Representative Buehling. Thank you, Chair. These are very impressive results. How do they compare to other states?
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Buehler. So there's three states that have PSRBs. All three are a little different, so it's a little difficult to compare because it's not apples to apples. My experience is with other states that they do not conditionally release as many individuals as us, and so it's very difficult to kind of track. The nearest population is Department of Corrections, and so that's sort of our comparison in this state. As you know, many individuals in Department of Corrections also have mental illness, so that's kind of our rationale for taking a look at comparing recidivism. But for example, in Connecticut, which has a PSRB, they just have a handful out on conditional release, is my understanding. And they have an indeterminate length of jurisdiction, so they have far less individuals under their supervision compared to us.
Thank you. quick follow-up?
Sure.
And what do you attribute your success?
Co-chairs Steiner Hayward, Ray Field, Representative Bueller. I think it is multi-factored. We have a dedicated community mental health workforce and programs that have designed forensic-minded programs that can deal with, as I said, co-occurring. So that might mean substance addiction issues. That might mean individuals that carry personality disorders, that have high-risk behaviors, and they've created programs to specifically address those treatment needs. Those programs are funded. And also, the board has a continuum of resources. You know, if we have to, we revoke individuals to the state hospital before they've had a full decompensation. You know, usually we can see what's a risk profile. We know what happened that first go around, and so we're constantly mitigating those risks. And when we see an individual is getting close to that same mental state, we can revoke if we have to. We can step somebody up to a secure facility. So it's having the array of continuum of care available. We're not stuck with keeping somebody in the community who's in the process of decompensating.
And if I could just add, the sort of trifecta of risk management is monitoring, supervision, and treatment. And if you provide the proper treatment for the identified risk factors and you monitor the areas of need and you supervise at appropriate levels, then you can anticipate or you can identify early signs, early warning signs of problems and take action to either increase levels of supervision, increase monitoring, or in some cases make the decision to revoke the person back to the hospital. And I think in that way, we're able to prevent. It's essentially a prevention strategy.
Sorry, I find this very interesting. So how often are patients monitored? Are they getting a touch every day? It's 20 hours a week of structured activity. Does that mean how is that put together?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Ray Field, Representative Bueller, it varies. For the most part, an individual first coming out of the hospital is definitely going to have daily contact. They're very likely to be living at a licensed residential home or facility that's manned 24/7 awake staff. So, and most of the treatment is done during the day. So they might have some free time where they can go out on pass and whatnot, but it's definitely daily initially when you're first out of the state hospital. We have some individuals that have been living independently for years that are working, that might not see their case manager except for once a week. So it really does depend on where they are in terms of their recovery. We have some individuals who will never be at that independent level, that they'll likely be at licensed residential based on their needs. But most individuals are able to move forward in recovery to that lower level of care. When I speak to community corrections, there's no doubt that our individuals have much more supervision than somebody coming out of prison. Anything else on recidivism? And I'll head back to my slide presentation. So this is some more data that I think speaks to our ability to conditionally release those in the community. We have less new GEI cases coming under our jurisdiction. Again, when I talked about that certified evaluator program, I think we're now I think that increases the chances that a bad GEI, for lack of a better phrase, is getting screened out earlier on before they're placed under our jurisdiction. This also speaks to the general trend that crime is going down overall. Our population is aging. And this gives our board a lot more flexibility without having to further develop community programs. This allows the waiting list to be much shorter, if at all, because we have less people that we have to supervise. And so that really helps move individuals out of the state hospital in a much faster manner. So this is the day in the life of a PSRB client. As I said, it's structured activity. Most of our individuals, as I said previously, are living at licensed residential when they're first out of the state hospital. We also have supported housing and individuals living independently. And that might include an ACT team. Those are the assertive community teams that this legislature has funded, where individuals live in their own home and the clinical services come to them in their apartment instead of having individuals live in a group home and have to go to a day treatment program. We get some of our monitoring tools from our community corrections folks. We have UAs, just like somebody on probation might, if it's clinically indicated. And we also have supported housing, supported employment. Particularly, there's some great work being done with our transitional age youth. Individuals, those 18 to 25-year-old males, the number one intervention the studies show is employment or education. And so some of our programs are doing some wonderful work with our young adult males. For the most part, we're keeping the vast majority of our individuals in the community every month. That's what this performance measure refers to. Our target is 99%, and pretty much every month we're meeting that target. We average one or two revocations a month. Again, now that we have less individuals under our supervision, we have a little more flexibility with our beds, and we're using existing community resources to step individuals up, for example. So let's say somebody relapses on meth, they're living in their own apartment, they're starting to decompensate, they need a medication change, we might step them up to a licensed residential bed while that medication change is occurring, where they can have more medication supervision and support, and then step the individual back down to their own apartment instead of revoking and sending them back to the state hospital.
Yeah, question?
Yes, sorry. Can you go back to the previous slide? So I'm interested in learning of the patients that you have, how many do end up going into getting their education or employment? Do you have that demographic information?
Co-Chair Stainer Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Alonzo Leon, I do not have that data. The community mental health providers are providing these services, so I can certainly pull the community mental health and give you a snapshot statewide. Certainly, you can imagine the counties with colleges, community colleges, and four-year colleges are going to have a lot more education attendance. And I can tell you that in the Portland metro area, there is a very robust employment services, but that exists in almost every county. So I can pull that and get you some data, give you a percentage for that, for sure.
Senator Myers.
Can you provide us with, because I don't see your data broken out, male, female categories, and also your ethnic categories?
Co-chairs Stainer Hayward, Rayfield, Senator Winters. So we have 15% of our adult clients are female, 2.3% are Asian, 7% are Black, 3 are Native American, 82% are white, and then there's about a 1% other category. On our youth, as I mentioned, we just got a new client, so now we have 8 youth. There are the 1 female, 7 male, and all are white. I believe all youth are white, all but one.
Okay.
So another big focus of our agency in terms of performance measures is to have on-time hearings. Again, on-time hearings is how we get individuals out into the community at the right time within our statutory timelines. That's how our board does business, and we continue to meet this performance measure. We have late hearings due to a multitude of reasons. Sometimes More time is needed to gather documents. Sometimes a party might request more time. We don't want to rush a conditional release hearing if somebody, we don't have all the information we need to make that decision. So despite that, we still are meeting this on-time hearing performance measure. So we continue to have a very positive public safety record with our recidivism rate. We're having our on-time hearings, and the GEI census has decreased 30% in the last 5 years. So that is what this body has asked us to do, and we're proud to say that we're continuing meeting that expectation.
So in terms of our major initiatives for the next biennium, we clearly want to continue our solid public safety record. We want to continue to manage the increased percentage that we project will continue at the current rates and higher of the patients that are on conditional release. We still need to complete the classification for the sex offenders under the ORS 163A. And we continue to collaborate with Oregon Health Authority, Department of Human Services, and the hospital to improve the barriers that have historically existed, the backdoor barriers to conditional release. In terms of challenges for the board, our ability to manage demands of the system within the current resources continues to be a challenge. There's some uncertainty regarding the future of Medicaid funding in our current climate. And the operating environment routinely includes misconceptions of those with mental illness and assumptions about PSRB patients in particular. And that includes individuals with histories of sexual offenses that some placements in the community either are reluctant to accept those patients, or in some cases they have neighborhood agreements that prohibit them from accepting those patients. But those currently represent some barriers for some folks. The housing market and the small percentage of availability causes rental barriers, as well as general barriers around employment. So those are the present challenges, and obviously there's different expectations from different stakeholders, and trying to address those continues to be a challenge for the board. In terms of the opportunities, well, we are taking advantage of our lower GEI numbers to implement process improvements. We continue, and I can wholeheartedly say that Juliet does a phenomenal job, but continue to implement community outreach regarding safety and effectiveness of conditional release, as well as its cost savings, and continue to provide input to the Oregon Health Authority and county mental health agencies regarding residential and clinical services that are needed, especially in these changing times. One of the demographics that we have is that the average age of the PSRB client is 46 years old. In anticipation of an aging population, we're going to have to meet some unique needs of that population as it ages. And then it's really important that we continue to work with local communities to help them develop strategies for managing our forensic population, and that involves training attorneys, judges, clinical folks and providers in the community who are evaluating our patients, evaluators, individuals, forensic evaluators who are evaluating patients, continuing the training so that we improve their ability to inform decision makers, so that proper patients are placed under our jurisdiction. And that's something that Juliet has been actively involved in and continues to be involved in.
So we have some proposed legislation. None of these have a fiscal, so for this body's information, it's more policy related. We have an administrative cleanup bill, and our what we call the stigmatizing statutory language. So for 40 years, individuals that have a developmental or intellectual or a traumatic brain injury in our system are referred to individuals who have a mental defect. And so we are working with the currently the Senate Judiciary to kind of create some more updated non-stigmatizing language, because words matter. And we also are looking for ways to better serve one of our primary customers, which are victims of crimes. Restorative justice has been implemented in Oregon Department of Corrections, in which case it's a very deliberative program where victims, if they request to meet with an offender, have a safe space with a neutral facilitator to have that sort of conversation if it's appropriate. So we're attempting to stand up a program similar to Department of Corrections. And then finally, there's several pieces in the criminal justice and civil commitment statutes where individuals who have certain findings are not being told the consequences of those findings. So, for example, if you're found guilty of a sex crime, you're told you're going to have to register, and you're inquired whether you still want to plead guilty, knowing that you have to register. And there's not that same notice requirement if you're found guilty except for insanity, and you're going to have to register. So we're hoping to add some language so judges will also mandate that those found GEI will have to be told all of the consequences of pleading GEI. And as far as civil commitment notification, under state and federal law, your name, if you are adjudicated and committed under civil commitment, you're not going to have your firearm privileges. And so you should be told that again, the same way you're told all the other rights that go away when you're civilly committed. So it's really a fairness bill is how we're referring to it. So those are our four legislative bills. And as far as our budget goes, it's current service level. We're a primary personnel services funded budget. Again, we don't pay for services, and so it's keeping the agency's FTE intact that allows our board to complete their mission. Any new legislation could potentially require us to look at whether or not our existing FTE can absorb additional duties. I will note that the last few duties, the sex offender classification, we just absorbed that with our existing FTE. So anything beyond that, we would just need to take a look. And we're going to ask that this Ways and Means remove the youth recidivism stat. Just given the low numbers, it just makes it very difficult to have some fidelity with just 7 or 8 youth under our jurisdiction.
Makes sense.
That is our overview. If there are any questions, and then I think Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. You mentioned during the presentation your successes are due to a robust community mental health, behavioral health access. Is it unique for this population that we're talking about, that you refer to a robust mental health access that we don't have for the general population? Generally, we don't refer to it as robust. What can you put that in context for me?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Hayden. Certainly, there are more services available to our clients versus somebody who's not under PSRB jurisdiction. That might mean one-on-one supervision if they need it for a short period of time or a long period of time. An individual who is not under PSRB supervision or any sort of commitment can choose to not receive services. And so in the case of some of our individuals, we have that mandated treatment that provides more services than otherwise a voluntary consumer would not have. Certainly, many of the programs that our clients receive are also available to those that want to seek out that treatment.
To follow up?
Yeah, please.
So does it come down to there's more funding available for this segment of the population, or that you can mandate it?
Co-chairs the success. Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, Representative Hayden. I think it's a combination of both. I think that it would be hard-pressed if somebody is not having mandated treatment to get funded one-on-one supervision if they need it. That's not something, generally speaking, that can get paid for if they need it. So I think it's a combination of both, but certainly the mandated treatment does help in terms of getting services.
Thank you.
Any other questions before? Oh, Senator Winters.
Just I'm glad that you're working on the truth in sentencing piece. That's a real plus. And just to add on. In the conversation that was raised by Representative Hayden, we spent for the last, I would say, at least 10 years or 12 years working to strengthen the work of PSRB, including, providing services, particularly on the residential side of the issue. That investment came from this body. If you've got a one-on-one supervision mandated versus a 65 caseload on the other side, you're going to see different kinds of results. Also, you have the issue of where, it's just totally the issue in the population that one is dealing with. Just want to ask you one quick question, though. Are you having conversation with DHS and OHA and the hospital piece on this whole stigmata issue, in educating not just the professional groups, but the general public at large?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rayfield, Senator Winters, I am at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, attending training sessions with the Oregon Health Authority DHS staff. I mean, we have what we call the roadshow, where we're going into the community presenting a forensic mental health presentation. PSRB is a small piece of that presentation. There's also discussions about alternatives to using the 370 commitment and among other things. And part of that certainly is educating practitioners and community. Sometimes we have to get the buy-in of the county commissioners who direct policies in their county and requests resources be allocated to some of these programs. So I also regularly meet with neighborhood associations, particularly when there's a new development. We do a lot of community outreach, respond to calls from law enforcement. I'm going to Bend next week, meeting with their law enforcement group there to discuss ways that we can ensure that revoked clients get transported in a timely manner. So there's constant community outreach and yes, absolutely working with the community partners to make sure we have a unified voice.
Okay, Ms. Lisper.
I'll switch.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. I'm Michelle Lisper with the Chief Financial Office, and my presentation is going to be fairly quick. As the agency reviewed the agency's emerging issues, placement for conditional release clients, administrative corrections to governing statutes that you just covered, and the increase of civil commitments. Civil commitments have not gone up that much, mostly due to the fact it's still a new tool in the council and Judiciary's committee's tool of arsenals to use. Over time, I'm sure we'll see some increases. The governor's budget supports the ongoing programs and the statewide adjustments for this agency. This gives you a little bit of history on the expenditures. As you can see, there haven't been that great a growth other than inflationary growth, like they indicated. The FTE count's still the same. They still have 11 full-time equivalents, and the governor's budget for 17-19 is proposing about $3 million. This just shows you a split that do the amount of work that they do, majority of it, 77% is personal services, the rest is services and supplies. A lot of that is attributed to basically indirect costs, rent, government, state service charges, cost to run their facility, their office in Portland. And that's pretty much all I have in the governor's budget, unless you have some questions for me.
Questions from Ms. Lisper. Okay, there wasn't a, oh, sorry, Representative Bueller.
Thanks, Chair. If you had to decrease your budget by 10%, what would you do?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Rachel, Representative Bueller, we would have to cut FTE. I mean, there's no way around it. We are a personal services agency. The majority is personal services, and we'd have to cut FTE. We can't just cut office supplies and vary. You know, there's some fixed costs, rent and whatnot, but we would have to cut hours.
Have you done that contingency plan?
We have, Representative Bueller, we have. And when we talk about allowing our board to do their business, we do that with hearings, and that takes FTE. The consequences of that potentially could be we'd have less hearings, less dockets, less cases on the dockets, because all of that requires file prep, or it's a judicial proceeding that requires file prep. And if we have less hearings, that means individuals potentially don't have decisions made to move them forward.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Just to pile on a little bit, and when they're not able to do that, the cost shifts. If they're in the hospital, which is a much greater cost than if they're working to actually put them back into the community. Just need to add that for context for those who are listening in.
Yeah, thank you. So just tell me what type of planning you've done, just the robustness of it. So have you done contingency planning for like a 5% cut, 10% cut, 20% cut?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Ray Phil, Representative Bueller, yes, we have. And obviously, we've done the incremental changes, and we would prioritize, of course, conditional release hearings. We'd start prioritizing hearings. And, you know, some of the staffing can be, you know, we've cross-trained to account for that in the event that does happen. But at the end of the day, it requires FTE to prep to have hearings, and that's how our board does decisions.
And just to be clear for the committee, no agency was asked to do a proposal for more than 15% cut. So 5, 10, and 15 is what they were pretty much all asked to do. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Any other? Sorry.
Just clarification, who asked them to do that?
The co-chairs.
It's standard every year.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you all very, very much. We appreciate the work that you're doing. It looks like things are going swimmingly, which is always a good thing to be able to say about such an important agency. And thank you, Director Britton and Dr. Balduzzi, for your incredibly hard work making this function well and protecting Oregonians by the work that you do and meeting your mandate. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
There was an opportunity for public testimony, but nobody has signed up. If there's anybody in the room who wishes to offer public testimony at this time, would you please wave at me? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5032. Is there any other business before the committee, Ms. Ames? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy your extra 30 minutes of freedom. We're adjourned.